The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by John Paul Brammer is titled, John Paul Brammer's Coming Out Journey Began in Walmart's Underwear Aisle. Who are we before we have a name for it? Back when he was a kid growing up in Oklahoma, author and advice columnist John Paul Brammer didn't have a label for his identity, but he knew he was transfixed by the glossy men's magazine covers, guys on ads in the underwear aisle of Walmart, and the cartoon hunks of the Disney Channel. In this essay for Oprah Daily's Coming Out series, Brammer ventures back to the Jurassic period of his sexuality to argue that the time before he outwardly and openly identified as gay matters just as much as the time after. For Brammer, the idea of quote-unquote coming out is a useful storytelling device, but it's never the whole story. Those private identity-clarifying moments are foundational too, even if they're less cinematic. Brammer's new memoir and essays, Hola Papi, How to Come Out in a Walmart Parking Lot and Other Life Lessons, is our now and contains essays as wise and emotionally affecting as this one. As a kid, I shopped for clothes in the Husky Boys section of Walmart. More of a chore than a passion, I'd be set loose to sift through polos, bootcut jeans, and graphic tees with quotes like, "Normal people scare me," written on the front in Comic Sans. The fun and exotic part was the adjacent underwear aisle, where scantily clad male models advertised the goods with rippling abs, cannonball biceps, and sometimes a face. I didn't stare at these men with lust, necessarily. It was more like one might stare at a dead bird, morbid curiosity, a rare opportunity for an up-close look at the anatomical truth of an elusive creature that is typically quick to flutter away. The looking begot itself. Huh. Why do I like looking at these things so much? I would ask myself, unable to turn away. Okay, fine, there was some lust, but I reliably swatted those thoughts off of me. The idea of gayness, inhabiting it or even entertaining it, was so far out of the question that it allowed me a sideways kind of agency. I couldn't possibly be gay, so it was fine to stare for a while. The underwear models weren't alone in the menagerie of things I liked to stare at. I say things intentionally because I didn't connect the pictures to human beings, never thought that the black and white torsos had any kind of interiority or were at risk of walking out of frame and pursuing other interests. I also didn't have to worry about rejection of any kind, though I wouldn't have known what that kind of rejection even tasted like back then. I was free to look, imagine, and then walk away. It was a similar story for the handsome actors on the glossy covers of magazines, cartoon guys like Hercules or Aladdin on the Disney Channel, which I would watch religiously, especially Aladdin. I'd set myself up close to the TV, cross-legged, ignoring the plots and musical numbers, to ogle at the tousled hair and exposed chest, or, heaven help me, the occasional entirely shirtless scene. But there was always, always a patina of deniability, of non-reality about these fellas. It's what made them better subjects for my longing stares, as doing so with the real boys, like my classmates, made me uncomfortable. I wasn't purposely denying anyone's humanity. It was just that humanity was the ingredient I dared not add, lest I have to reckon with my unfortunate situation. I was not straight. I wouldn't say this is a universal experience, but I do think that for many LGBTQ people, particularly if we grew up in environments that encouraged repression, like my upbringing in the Catholic Church, had to quickly become adept at managing our burgeoning, prototypical sexuality with an equally strong urge to deny the truth of our appetites. And so in many cases, I negotiated myself into a place where I could stare at certain things and let myself feel a certain way while still maintaining that, no, I was heterosexual, actually. I could look at the underwear models, the cartoons, I could even steal glances of real guys at the mall or at school, so long as I took great care not to allow these individual actions to cohere into anything resembling an identity. That was the ultimatum. It's only recently, now that I've been an out gay man for a decade and can't imagine life without the occasional disastrous grinder date, that I've thought to revisit that Jurassic period of my sexuality. Particularly, I'm interested in the question, was I not, though I wouldn't have admitted it for $1 million, as gay then as I am now? Or in other words, did my being gay begin when I came out? Or did it begin when I first loitered in the underwear aisle of my hometown Walmart in Oklahoma, staring at desaturated nipples? My coming out story isn't anything special. I was in college, tried recreational Adderall for the first time, and found I couldn't shut up. I talked and talked and talked, and it wasn't until the effect wore off that I realized I'd confessed my attraction to men over Facebook Messenger to multiple acquaintances. Because I struggled to do anything halfway, I told my parents the next time I saw them, I'm gay. That's fine, was essentially the response, and that was that. Quickly thereafter, I pursued my first homosexual encounter, went to my first gay bar, dated my first living, breathing red flag, and somewhere during all that, I decided I was out. Was it the moment I admitted it to myself? The moment I told my parents? Or was it the moment I acted on my desires? It's not like we hold a graduation party for this kind of thing, so it's hard to say. There is a certain emphasis, both in gay culture and in heterosexual imagining of gay culture, on what I'd call the becoming. The gay life is narratively partitioned into post and pre. There is the time before you came out and the time after. And the time before is a sort of identity and weight. It hasn't flowered. It is not itself. You are not you. Not yet. I've even seen this applied to men navigating the gray areas of what I'll call outness. These are men who might be notorious in the community for hooking up with guys and then denying it, for being on Grindr with their face cropped out of the photo, for being, well, a closet case. This is part of the coming out story, too. For being out to mean something, there have to be people who, for one reason or another, are in. In and out constitute an imperfect system, to be sure. One that calls into question what identity means, how it functions, and how we understand it. To me, the very act of navigating spaces like the Walmart underwear aisle with any degree of anxiety or secret purpose speaks to an otherness that is hallmarked to identity. It is just as foundational an experience as coming out to the act of announcing, either to yourself or others, I am. Before we even have a vocabulary to formalize our identities, before we set about manicuring the wilderness of our desires with categories and communities, we are asked to reckon with our urges, asked to check and double check that they are acceptable, that they can coexist with whatever world we are born into. In the case of queer people, that reckoning and the anxieties and sacrifices and stolen glances that come with it seems to be equally as important, if not even more so, as the lives we lead after we've put a name to it. I think back to the younger version of me standing in the Walmart underwear aisle, a kid who didn't even know what he wanted and would have been too afraid to name it even if he had. Yes, it was an existence that elided the truth, but it was an existence nonetheless, one that isn't so much distinct from life as an out gay person as it is in direct conversation with it. Coming out remains incredibly important. It's something to be celebrated. It helps us identify, find, and support each other in a world that doesn't make existing easy. But I think it's also worthwhile to note that it's more of a narrative tool to organize our autonomy over desires and sentiments we've lived with for a long time, before we even knew what gay was, before we even knew there was a community out there waiting for us. It's a storytelling device, and I mean that in a positive way. We are story-driven animals. To that end, I've come to realize that those underwear models and cartoon hunks played a more important role than I thought. No story is complete, after all, without its supporting cast. Our next article by Craig Melvin is titled, Today host Craig Melvin reflects on his complicated relationship with his pops. Pops never drank hard liquor. He was strictly a beer guy. For decades, he drank only Budweiser and at some point switched over to Coors Light. Later, when things got bad, he drank whatever beer he could get his hands on, whatever was cheapest. Cigarettes were his other constant. He invariably had a Newport in one hand, a beer in the other, in the house, in his bed, in the yard, cutting Grandma Renee's grass. And behind the wheel of his 1973 Pontiac Le Mans. It was painted an intense metallic emerald hue that you could see coming from blocks away, and that Pontiac labeled verdant green. It had an all-white interior and a matching white vinyl top, which Pops was particularly proud of. Inevitably, when he was driving, there would be a couple of 8-track tapes on the passenger seat floor, old-school R&B or funk that he would listen to from time to time. There would also be a Budweiser in a plastic cup, stuck in a small gap between the front seats, and hanging out of his mouth a cancer stick. The windows would be down, not because of the smoke, but because the car's air conditioner never worked properly. Long before everyone acknowledged that doing so was terribly dangerous, Pops was literally drinking and driving, and without either of us or anyone else in the car wearing seatbelts. As I look back on it now, I wonder, what the hell was he thinking? What was my mom thinking, letting us ride with him? He received several DUIs over the years, and he caused a couple of relatively minor accidents, including one that helped us finally get him into rehab. But fortunately, he was alone on all these occasions. A host of reasons kept him from being the dad I wanted him to be, the dad I needed. He didn't set out to be a bad father. He didn't want to not be around. But in a way, he became a parent with both hands tied behind his back, hindered by his family history, his own parents' shortcomings, and dearth of resources, his lack of a good role model in his own father. There was a systemic and overt racism he faced as a black man of his generation. And there was the legacy of alcoholism, and likely an undiagnosed underlying depression. Was his drinking in part an attempt to self-medicate? Possibly. My dad spent the better part of his life unhappy about various aspects of his life, and he found comfort and solace in alcohol. For most of his life, he was able to manage it to a certain extent, until he couldn't. My father was born in 1950 in a federal prison in West Virginia. That is a heavy burden to carry into life, but he and I never talked about it, not for decades, not until I was 41, when I sat down to write this book. We never talked about why my grandmother had been imprisoned or for how long. We didn't talk about what, if anything, he remembered about her imprisonment or who cared for him until she was released. We also didn't talk about his father's alcoholism or the way his father squandered his life and nearly died alone. We didn't talk about how that legacy has affected him across his 70 years on this earth. We didn't talk about whether his father's problems contributed to his own alcoholism. We didn't talk about how his parents not being present probably led him to not being around as much as he wanted when he became a father to my two brothers and me. We didn't talk about what toll those absences took on his marriage to my mother, or why they stayed together when they had so many reasons not to. Back in the day, however, when I was very little, I thought he was the epitome of cool. He was a 1970s guy through and through. Almost like he'd been frozen in time when Jimmy Carter was in office. The aging Le Mans and the 8-tracks on the floor were only part of it. He kept his hair in an afro through most of my childhood, and well into the 90s he would wear shirts with butterfly collars and pants made from an array of polyesters. It was ages before I ever saw Pops in a simple pair of jeans. My dad's refusal to chase trends was even kind of admirable. He had a timeless sense of style, let's say. One thing I genuinely admire about him is that he's comfortable in his own skin. To put it bluntly, he doesn't give a shit what other people think about him. But by the time I entered middle school, like most kids that age, I had grown self-conscious about him. I thought, what the heck, Pops, you are a public embarrassment. It wasn't just the drinking, he was also such a throwback. He still is. He didn't have a cell phone until deep into the 2010s, and he still refuses to text. He doesn't have an email account either. In fact, I've never seen him use a computer. It's all a reflection of his personality. He's stubborn and, his former vices aside, careful with his money. Pops hasn't made a car payment my entire life, not since the Ford administration. He bought the Le Mans new in 1972 while he was in the Air Force. After it finally died in the 2000s, he drove hand-me-down cars. First, a white Buick LeSabre from his sister Carrie May, then a Mercury Topaz from his brother James, which became my first car, and then Grandma Florence's 1993 Honda Civic. For a while, he was even driving a 1980s vintage wheelchair-accessible van that Mom had bought to transport Grandma Florence when she was near the end of her life. To this day, Pops doesn't have a debit or credit card. He used to say, if you can't buy something in cash, minus a house or a car, then you don't really need it. He lived that. On Fridays growing up, if we needed cash for something over the weekend, like going out or shopping, we'd have to put in a request Thursday night, or at the latest, early Friday morning. He would go to the bank on Friday, and that would be it for the weekend. A real pain when I became a teenager. His range of interests is very narrow. He never developed hobbies or passions other than drinking and smoking. And for most of his life, he didn't hang out with people who didn't do one or both. I suppose you could argue that his constant tinkering with the Le Mans was a hobby. It broke down so often I couldn't begin to count the hours and days I spent with him under the hood, and sometimes under the car itself. He was always working on it with me as his designated assistant. He had a Chilton repair manual for old Pontiacs that was 800 pages thick, practically an encyclopedia. Whenever I saw him thumbing through it, I knew I was about to be drafted into helping him on a project that could take anywhere from 2 days to 2 weeks to what felt like a decade, never just a couple of hours. Imagine you're a kid. It's a Saturday morning and you want to play with friends or watch cartoons, but your dad says, hey, can you come out and help me with the car? Ah, dang it, again with the Le Mans. I might have been more enthusiastic if he had been teaching me something or letting me get my hands dirty. But he didn't trust me to work on the car, and that never changed. I never got promoted. By that I mean, at 6 years old, I'm handing him a socket wrench and holding a flashlight, and at 15, I'm still doing the same thing. As I got older, I realized it wasn't about my actually being useful in any serious way. It wasn't about my contributing. It was just about me being there. He wanted a buddy. That didn't mean he necessarily wanted to talk, however. One thing about my dad is that he's comfortable in silence. He's not one of those people who have to talk to fill a void. Over the years, people have told me, you're a good interviewer because you listen. You'll let someone just talk and not interrupt them. And I think that's something I got from Pops. Underneath the hood of the Le Mans, we could go 10, 15, 20 minutes without saying a thing, aside from his cussing at the car. We were just together, being in the moment. That was our hang. I didn't have a choice in the matter, but as I grew older, I learned to tolerate and even appreciate it. I suspect working on the Le Mans together was a way for a man who had a hard time connecting with people to be available for me, to be a father. From time to time, he would try to impart certain life lessons. He used to say, "Keep your nose clean." That was one of his favorite sayings. Or, "Don't go taking any wooden nickels," whatever that actually means. Even his advice was old school, though another favorite, "don't go doing drugs," was more up to date. These life lessons would usually come while we were under the hood of the Le Mans. When I got a little older, he added, "don't go getting a girl pregnant" to the menu. That was as close as we ever got to him giving me a talk about the birds and the bees. He must have assumed I picked up the rest of it in school, or at least the schoolyard, which was a correct assumption. But I needed him in a lot of other ways over the next decades, and he just wasn't up to it. But in 2018, when he was 67, Pop summoned up a strength and courage I didn't know he had to face down his demons and his biology to become sober. It was a game changer for our family. I now see my own father through a very different lens than I did when I was growing up in the 1980s and 90s in Columbia, South Carolina, especially now that I'm father to a son and daughter. Lawrence Melvin, Pops to me, could be mean. He was distant and antisocial. When his drinking got really bad, as it increasingly did when I became a teenager, his speech would slur, and more than once he threw up on himself while he was passed out in his bed. He almost never made it to my Little League games. He wasn't around for most school events. He missed a lot of my childhood. Frankly, even when he was around, even when he was sober, he was often sullen and remote. I resented his absences and his emotional distance, and for years, even decades, I couldn't see past that. But when you have your own children, you become more aware of the sacrifices fathers make to provide for their families. I began to see the toll living took on my dad, what he gave up, how things might have looked through his eyes while he worked a tough job with brutal hours to put food on our plates and a roof over our heads. I've also come to realize that Pops wasn't just a drunk. He was sick. He was an addict. He is an addict. You can see that my feelings about my father and my childhood are complicated and that I'm still sorting them out. The same with my feelings about fatherhood in general. That's part of the reason I'm writing this book. At a basic level, my job as a journalist is to ask people questions and tell their stories. I've been doing that professionally for 2 decades now. But in writing about my father and sorting through our tangled relationship, I'm not only figuring out how to make peace with him, I'm learning how to be a better father myself. It took work and time, but we've come to a good place, and so has he. When we were winding down one of the interviews I conducted with him for the book, I asked Pops if he had anything he wanted to add. He surprised me by returning to the subject of his having been born in prison. For a long time, when I found out that I was a prison baby, man, that thing used to bother me. But one day I was sitting around thinking about it. I said, shit, at least she had me. And you know, it wasn't my doing I was born in prison. Our next article by Samantha Vincenti is San Francisco Once Broke My Heart. Here's how we got back together. One's destination is never a place, but a new way of looking at things. Henry Miller wrote those words in the story of his years in California, and the sentiment was on my mind as I made my return to San Francisco to seek fresh adventure for exactly 72 hours. Until this past August, I hadn't been back to San Francisco since I lived there nearly 12 years ago, nor had I revisited my own deeply complicated personal history with the place. My first encounter with the Bay Area came right after college graduation, when my then-boyfriend convinced me to join him, his dog Irie, and his musty collection of imitation Pendleton blankets in a big cross-country move. I'd never even been to California before, but I was in love and absolutely nothing held me back in New York. So we packed up his parents' old Volvo and headed west. In the weeks following our arrival, several things became crystal clear. My hippie boyfriend and I were wildly incompatible. San Francisco weather was much different than what my Baywatch-fueled, geographically ignorant impressions of California had led me to expect. And the entire part of the country was intent on chewing me up and spitting me out. Speaking of chewing, Irie had eaten all of my bras. I experienced my first major heartbreak in San Francisco when Mr. Dreamcatcher gave me the boot after 3 months. And while I'd spent over a year more in San Francisco living with the few friends I had there, I mostly recall walking around broke and alone with Morrissey lyrics blaring from my headphones as I scrunched my face against the outer sunsets near constant cold front. I was 22 then, lonely, homesick, and only beginning to figure out how to move about in the world. Sure, I had a gorgeous view of the ocean every morning as I walked to the Muni streetcar that took me on an equally picturesque ride to work. And I had my fair share of fun when I wasn't sobbing over my ex, too, but I never felt fully there. I hadn't yet realized what I know now, that anyone's perception of somewhere new, especially a city, isn't objective reality. It's shaped by who you are, the people you're spending time with, and the experiences you have. That's why when Chase Sapphire invited me to spend a long weekend in San Francisco for the Outside Lands Music Festival, I jumped at the chance. I was more than ready to overwrite my literally foggy memories and to get to know the city again, this time with my old colleague, Molly Sims. Our friendship goes all the way back to our college days at Sarah Lawrence, and she even visited me in San Fran way back when. Who better to return to the scene with? Our first stop upon arrival was the Stanford Court, a boutique hotel in Knob Hill. The elevator rides were soundtracked by Bay Area greats, Counting Crows, E-40, Tony, and our corner room welcomed us with highly grammable views. As I admired the iconic Transamerica Pyramid, cable cars ding-ding down below its street level. We'd been in the city for barely an hour and we were already one Tony Bennett song away from being the San Franciscoist. We hopped in a cab and headed to the Mission District, my old stomping grounds, where I was delighted to find that the authentic Mexican food options are still plentiful. The enchiladas poblanos at Puerto Alegre were delicious, and I probably did not need that second margarita. But what's a girl's trip without a daytime buzz or two? After a couple hours of mural peeping and shopping along Valencia Street, it was time for an early dinner. That 3-hour jet lag was hitting hard. Chez Fico, a hotspot that already had eager diners lining up on the staircase at 5:30 p.m., served up plate after plate of that Cal Italian fare. Though their pizzas garner the most buzz, the chopped antipasto salad and pasta dishes are the things I wish were in front of me again right now. The next morning, after amping up with some Blue Bottle coffee, fun fact, they're headquartered across the bay in Oakland, we headed to Outside Lands, a festival held in Golden Gate Park. While music is front and center, boasting a lineup featuring Paul Simon, Childish Gambino, and my country pop queen Kacey Musgraves, the annual event is sprawling. There was brand new territory to discover around every corner. Wine lands, beer lands, and the uber Californian grasslands, which spotlights the celebration, education, and integration of cannabis products into daily life. It was essentially an open-air market where over 21 festival goers could purchase joints, gummies, THC vape cartridges, and everything else they're putting weed in these days. And yes, there was a smoking section. Saturday was a full day of watching music in delightfully comfy sweater weather, including a stage-side viewing of Big Wild set, courtesy of Chase Sapphire. But Sunday was, dare I say, the best San Francisco day of my entire life. Back when I was a sullen, recently dumped resident working a part-time temp job, I somehow never made it to one of the city's most popular attractions, Fisherman's Wharf. Touristy as it may be, the draw was all about the three S's, seafood, stunning vistas, and sea lions. After putting away a dozen oysters while admiring Alcatraz and the Golden Gate Bridge, we said hello to those magnificent, bewhiskered beasts on the pier, then made a pit stop for some salt and straw ice cream. Then it was back to Outside Lands, where we decompressed for a bit in the comfy Chase Sapphire Lounge. Watching Kacey Musgraves' opener set was slow burn as the afternoon sun shined above and a glass of white wine in my hand was pure perfection. We capped off our last night in San Francisco with a full circle moment, drinks at the Tonga Room and Hurricane Bar. The restaurant and bar, nestled in the Fairmont Hotel, is infamous for a man-made lagoon upon which a band plays top 40 covers in a boat and get periodically rained on. It was actually my second time visiting. The first was back in my early 20s, and incredibly, Molly was with me that time too. At 23, I'd never heard of a tiki bar before, so I was suitably bowled over by their over-the-top glam decor, and I also had no idea that drinks could cost more than $5. It felt pretty great to come back so many years and Mai Tais later to discover that while I was still awed by the atmosphere, I was 1,000% more at ease. My long weekend in San Francisco canceled out every bad memory I had of my past time there, though fortunately, I'll never forget the lessons. I now associate the city with perfect temperatures, delicious food, and laughing till I cry while huffing and puffing up the crazy steep California street, promising Molly we both have tight San Francisco-style tushes by the trip's end. It turns out fog is pretty cool when it's not a meteorological allegory for your situational depression. Was the bay always this sparkly? Our next article by Christine Coppa is titled Granny Pods Allow Elderly Family Members to Live in a High-Tech Backyard Cottage. AARP estimates that about 23 million Americans take care of their elderly parents. But when it comes to finding a place for mom and dad to live during their golden years, nursing homes might not make the most sense from a financial standpoint in the long run. Plus, letting an aging parent live alone may cause anxiety and guilt for some families. And while some adult children are willing to welcome grandma or grandpa into their own homes with open arms, others might not have the space. What to do? Allow us to introduce you to the granny pod. Also known as the med cottage, the tiny home is essentially a portable hospital room designed by a Blacksburg, Virginia company with help from Virginia Tech. Think of it as sort of a guest house with lots of high-tech medical extras. Med cottages are prefabricated and designed to be installed in the backyard behind the main home, zoning laws permitting, of course. The small dwelling is hooked up to the main house's existing sewer, water, and power lines. Standard safety features include hand railings, defibrillators, first aid supplies, lighted floorboards, and a soft floor to minimize damage from falls. The cost? All of this will run you between $85,000 to $125,000. A so-called granny pod can be compared to a bungalow from the outside and a nice hotel suite on the inside, with room for a bed, living room space, kitchenette, and bathroom. The cottage is about 12 by 24 feet, essentially the size of a spacious master bedroom. Double French doors add an attractive touch and also accommodate a wheelchair and hospital equipment if needed. There are three styles, Med Cottage, Classic, and Grand. Med Cottages have gotten mixed reviews, with some noting that the dwellings could cause problems with neighbors or be seen as putting an aging parent in storage, but others find that it's a practical luxury to have mom close by in a cozy cottage. You can find out more on the developer's website. Our next article by Samantha Vincenti is The Lady in the Dales, Liz Carmichael, was a trans woman, scammer, and devoted mom. Liz Carmichael in the Dale, the invention that would ultimately land her in prison for fraud, arrived right on time. As founder of the 20th Century Motor Car Corporation in 1974, the widowed mother of five made headlines as living proof of the exciting possibilities touted by the women's liberation movement. What's more, Carmichael claimed to have a solution to the oil crisis that was hitting Americans' gas prices hard, the Dale. A futuristic three-wheeled car that would get 70 miles to the gallon and cost only $2,000, challenging the big three automakers' hold on the market. Except the Dale wasn't real, or nowhere near viable to drive anyway. And Carmichael wasn't a widow. She was a transgender woman who was still married to her fourth wife, Vivian. As unfurled in The Lady in the Dale, HBO Max's four-part docuseries, when Carmichael's public activities put her private life in the spotlight, the fact that the entrepreneur was trans played a large part in how she and her legal case were perceived. The case will likely draw comparisons to the subject of another HBO documentary about Theranos founder Elizabeth Holmes, but director Zachary Drucker depicts the events through the lens of trans history. "It's stranger than fiction," says Drucker, who says Transparent star Jay Duplass first told her about the saga. "But by the end of the project, I realized that Liz's story has so many prescient themes that reverberate in trans life today. Her lack of access to trans-related health care, her inability to gain lawful employment after transitioning, the way that she was treated in the media, and the way that her identity was conflated with her life as a criminal." Here was a central challenge in telling Liz Carmichael's story. While she experienced what so many trans people have experienced historically, the mischaracterization of her body as inherently dishonest and thus criminal, Carmichael also did break financial laws, and her family lived on the lam due to crimes Carmichael committed in her pre-transition life as Jerry Dean Michael. I wonder if the reason why I'd never heard of Liz Carmichael is because that image of her was so persistent. Liz Carmichael is Jerry Dean Michael, masquerading as a woman to evade law enforcement, Drucker says. Thus, the filmmakers decided to keep those two threads as separate as possible. Editor's note: while OprahMag.com follows GLAAD's best practices on covering the trans community and not using one's original birth name or sex, Jerry Michael is named in The Lady in the Dale, and Liz's life before transitioning is treated as a separate narrative. While the first episode is about the 45 years leading up to Liz's transition, in the second episode, we intentionally never say anything about Liz being trans, so you're thinking about her as a mother and an entrepreneur, Drucker, who is a trans woman herself, explains. Later in the series, when watching the events that follow her arrest, you're reconfronted with how society and the criminal justice system, right down to the members of her trial jury, really perceive Liz's life as a trans woman. Liz Carmichael was born in 1937. As a child, Carmichael lived in Jasonville, Indiana, before moving to Detroit, Michigan. In interviews promoting the Dale that are recreated by a voice actor in the documentary, Carmichael described a dirt-poor upbringing as a girl on a farm, though classmates remembered her upbringing differently. When folks transitioned in the 60s, they were directed by their doctors to tell positive stories about their lives to make a false backstory, Drucker explains. I was an Indiana farm girl. I grew up tearing down tractor engines while the other girls were yada, yada, yada. That doesn't derivate from what the majority of trans people had to make up about themselves in the 20th century. Being found out could, and still can, mean a loss of work, housing, or, as the murder of trans man Brandon Tina first illuminated for many in the late 90s, death. Michael married four times, according to an FBI file cited in the documentary. He was charged with desertion for leaving his first wife, Marga, whom he met while stationed in Germany, and their two children. He married a woman named Juanita in 1954 and had two more kids. She estimated that they moved 21 times by the time of their split in 1956, just 2 years later. His 1958 marriage to a woman named Betty Sweets that he'd known for 4 weeks ended within a year, but not before they'd conceived a baby daughter. Jerry Dean Michael and his wife, Vivian Barrett, went on the run in 1961. A door-to-door salesman and failed newspaper publisher, Michael was repeatedly arrested or fired for pocketing money through side schemes prior to becoming Liz Carmichael. Vivian Barrett met Michael while working as a waitress when she was 16, according to her brother, Charles Richard Barrett. Michael made fake IDs and passed bad checks, though when Charles was arrested alongside his brother-in-law for those crimes, he said Michael made sure to take the fall, and ever the self-promoter asked for the article about the rest as a souvenir. Now living in California, Michael was arrested again in 1961 for printing and distributing fake money through a counterfeit front called the Los Angeles Distribution Company. Caught, Michael jumped bail with Vivian, and they grew to a family of seven while living on the run. Never living anywhere for more than a few months, they changed identities using stolen records and homeschooled their five kids. When Jerry first informed Vivian that he was actually Liz, a trans woman, an upset Vivian left town with two of their children. In a letter attempting to explain what she was going through, Jerry wrote to Vivian, "I'm not a man anymore, at least not in the sexual sense, if I ever was." Ultimately, it was a love letter stating, "I'd walk through fire for you and the kids." Vivian returned home. As Carmichael's secretary years later at 20th Century Motor, they said they were sisters-in-law. Shortly after Carmichael's criminal trial over the Dale fraud, Vivian filed for divorce. Liz continued fugitive life on the road with the kids, who chose to travel with her, while Vivian remarried shortly before her death of cancer. In The Lady and the Dale, their son Michael remembers the two as like sisters. Two of Liz and Vivian's kids appear in The Lady and the Dale. Liz and Vivian's oldest daughter, Candy, features prominently in the HBO documentary, and their son Michael appears as well. Two of their other kids are deceased, and their third surviving sibling declined to be interviewed on camera. It may seem like a blind spot, but we wanted to respect the pain in their lives and not exploit their names, Drucker says of their absence from the series. "We might have had a strange family, but we were a tight-knit family," Candy says in The Lady and the Dale. She and her siblings remember their upbringing as chaotic but adventurous. At one point before coming out as Liz, Jerry owned a pet store and their house ran wild with creatures. Jerry couldn't do anything on a small basis, she adds. It was a difficult and slow process to obtain the hormones and surgery required to transition in the 1960s and 1970s. Liz self-administered hormone injections procured from veterinarians, according to Candy, and had traveled to Mexico for breast implant surgery in 1969 while hoping to one day get bottom surgery or vaginoplasty. Liz and Vivian's kids were slowly acclimated to the idea of Liz too. "The first part of the transition was just calling Daddy Jerry," Candy says. Over about 3 years, Jerry became Aunt Jerry, then Aunt Liz, and then our mother. Candy would hear her practice speaking as a woman through the door. "I think a lot of people go, 'Oh, Liz became trans at 45. But Liz was always trans, operating with the tools available to her, says Drucker. She transitioned when she could later in life. She messed up in a lot of ways, but that's the reality of the messiness of trying to figure yourself out in a world that doesn't have a place for you. Tucker Carlson's father, Dick Carlson, led the charge on investigating Carmichael. With the founding of 20th Century Motor Car Corporation, Liz became a widely known figure in California in 1973 via her charm and P.T. Barnum-esque claims of what the Dale would be. At one point, she insisted its body was bulletproof, and another time she'd said she safely drove the prototype into the ocean. This attracted the attention of L.A. TV station KABC reporter Dick Carlson, who admits in The Lady in the Dale that he and colleague Pete Noyes were always bothered by the fact that she looked like a man, and it propelled their interest. Carlson and Noyes played an instrumental role in bringing 20th Century Motors' shadier practices to both the public's and the California security investigators' attention, airing multiple news investigations. In 1975, Carmichael and five 20th Century Motor colleagues were ultimately arrested for conspiracy, grand theft, fraud, and counterfeiting after the company moved from California to Texas, though Carmichael maintained throughout the trial that the Dale was real and simply not ready yet. When the police arrived to search the Carmichael family's abandoned home in Dallas as the arrests were made, they found a variety of padded women's undergarments and gender transition-related reading material. Acting on letters found from Liz to Vivian, authorities visited Vivian's brother, who informed them of Liz's trans identity. Authorities and media outlets uniformly portrayed Liz as a male criminal who tried to trick the public by cross-dressing. "She really is a he," was the title of a 1975 People article on the scandal reflective of the Times' tone, which alternately portrayed Carmichael's trans identity as a lie. Apparently, the 6-foot, 175-pound Michael passed himself off as Liz Carmichael for 13 years. And a perversion. He evidently derived as much pleasure from his tightrope walk between sexual identities as from his numerous scams to relieve the public of loose cash. To this day, Carlson maintains the belief that Carmichael's trans identity was a malevolent ruse, inseparable from her criminal activities. "She used them just like she used Vivian," he says of Carmichael's kids and The Lady in the Dale. If you didn't think that was kind of sick, you wouldn't think Jeffrey Dahmer was a normal person. Liz is the trans boogeyman of Tucker Carlson's childhood, Drucker jokes. When Dick comes along, he's asking good questions and has integrity as a journalist, she continues. And then you realize that his bias is a motivating factor. He goes above and beyond to drag her through the mud. Liz's kids, Candy and Michael, remember both of their mothers fondly in The Lady in the Dale, sharing memories of family picnics and Carmichael's umpteenth reinvention as a flower vendor in Texas. After enjoying years with her family after her time in prison, Liz Carmichael died in 2004 after several health complications, including cancer. "Her story is so bombastic and extraordinary," says Drucker. And as a protagonist, Liz was incredibly human in her many flaws. Our next article by Alicia Ray is titled Confessions of a Terminally Single Romance Novelist. Most people would consider life to have only two guaranteed events, birth and death. My mother would add a graduate degree in marriage to that list, both preferably cleared by the age of 29. Within that time frame, I managed to be born and to get the degree, but as I edged deeper into my 30s and remained terminally single, my family got increasingly anxious. "You're being too picky," my mother told me. "Your expectations are too high." That's an accusation that most romance readers are familiar with to some extent. We hold unrealistic expectations about love. As a professional romantic who makes a living writing those love stories, surely my expectations must be even higher. But while it may be unrealistic to expect a real-life hero to be a billionaire Navy SEAL with six-pack abs who moonlights as a Viking cowboy, it is not unrealistic to expect love, kindness, and respect, and yes, even orgasms, if that's something that's important to you, from a partner. At speaking engagements, I always emphasize this point because I fear fellow romantics have also been programmed to believe they are setting their sights too high. I fear it because until recently, and despite what I've publicly proclaimed, I didn't quite believe it for myself. I don't claim that this is the experience of all heterosexual South Asian American women, but for me, personally, the second I hit my 20s and the clock on my marriageable prospects began to tick, I felt a mounting pressure to turn myself into an asset, useful to someone so I could define myself around them. I dreamt of my future husband and family's future instead of my own. Intellectually, I knew I had value as an individual, partially because the romance novels I'd devoured since the age of 12 had told me so. Still, I couldn't help but feel that everything I did or didn't do was part of an elaborate good place-ish points total, but not a total that got me into heaven or hell. Oh no, that would have been easier. This was a total that would determine what kind of man I'd marry, or if I'd marry anyone at all. Young and never married? Plus 1,800. Get a tattoo? Minus 150. Attend a prestigious law school? Plus 600. Not a size 4? Negative 1,000. Enjoy sex? Plus 320. Enjoy it a little too much? Minus 50. Publish novels? Plus 800. Oh, but romance novels? Minus 400. It would be one thing if I didn't want a relationship, but I was a diehard romantic well before I picked up my first romance. So out into the dating market I went, clutching my value to my chest. The men were allotted points too, I discovered, but it seemed it was far easier for them to rack them up and harder for them to lose. Society forgave more of their mistakes and shortcomings, so I forgave them too. While I wrote heroines who stood firm in their right to have it all, I made sure my guy had it all. Still, no matter how deep I shoved my own wants and needs, more than one ex tossed the too high expectations accusations at me during our exit interviews. I didn't know how to tell those men and my worried family the truth. I wasn't being picky, just the opposite. I was so hyper-conscious of not having those dreaded unrealistic expectations that I tolerated the person I was with, even if they only met the bare minimum. After all, there was that unwritten, inexplicable point system tallying in the background, and I was losing hard-won points simply by the passage of time. If I had to settle for less than a grand romance, so be it. That was reality, or so I'd been told. One night I met a man. On our first date, he took me to a rooftop bar overlooking the brightest lights of Los Angeles. I cracked a nerdy joke about taxes, and he took my hand and asked for my ring size. Cynical as any modern single woman in her 30s, I rolled my eyes and brushed the line off. "Doesn't this feel different?" he insisted. I deflected again, but in my heart, the hope that I'd shoved deep into a casket shivered awake. Was he also a fellow romantic? Had he also been forced to bury his expectations down deep? I fell for him at some point. Nothing he did was remarkable or rose to the level of romance novel heroism, but it inched just a hair higher than my lowest expectations. Reliably returning my calls and texts, praising my brain and ambitions, making coffee for me. When his initial romantic gestures disappeared, I told myself that was fine. I'm a pragmatic person as well. When Valentine's Day and my birthday came and went with nothing more than quick texts, I told myself that was fine too. Some people's love languages didn't lean towards presents. When the sex was mostly focused on him or when he told me that he didn't like to cuddle, I told myself it was fine. I could buy a vibrator and a body pillow. After all, we had similar upbringings. He was ambitious and successful and mostly kind and had a family I could easily fit into. These were the things I'd been raised to consider when seeking a potential mate. Not whether we were sexually compatible or if our senses of humor perfectly aligned. One night, about 9 months in, I ran out of patience when he kept needling me about something. I told him to stop it, that it hurt my feelings. He grew visibly angry, said, "I don't give a fuck about your feelings," and stormed upstairs. Sitting in his kitchen counter, I thought about picking up my car keys and leaving. That was what any of my heroines would have done. That's what I would have told a stranger to do. But I heard the whispers in my ear about what I was worth, and I went upstairs. I grew increasingly upset as we fought for hours. Not so much because of the argument, but because of what my gut was telling me. This isn't what you want or need. You'll be so unhappy if you stay. Don't be picky, my head immediately countered. This could be the best you get. Temper your expectations. After he told me I was too emotional and got in bed, I popped half a Xanax to stop my sobbing. It was one of the rare times I'd used the medicine outside of the airplane rides it had been prescribed for. I envisioned years of popping pills, and then I shoved that image out of my head. It was fine. He grew distant over the next few months, and the more distant he grew, the more anxious I became. I inflated his best qualities in my mind and tried to drown out the worst ones. I took more pills to sleep so I wouldn't have to think about the points or being alone. In a plot twist I didn't see coming, my mother firmly told me to end things with him, that she'd rather I be happy and alone over miserable but technically in a relationship. The week before the one-year anniversary of that rooftop date, I called him to talk through my misgivings. I had spent all day working on my next book, and I'd practiced the words I wanted to say by writing them into my characters' mouths. I was optimistic. After all, my hero and heroine respected each other's needs. Why couldn't we do the same in real life? Calmly, logically, I told him how ignored and anxious I felt. He was stunned to realize there was any problem at all, which stunned me. Then he responded with the words that struck the death knell of our relationship. I'm really uncomfortable that you have these expectations of me. You mean my expectations of you are too high? I was prepared to counter that familiar accusation. I wasn't prepared for his curveball. No, I'm uncomfortable that you have any expectations of me. I don't have any of you, he said. Except that wasn't true. I'd helped with his work even when I had my own deadlines, coached him on his career, stroked his ego, stocked his favorite beer in my fridge, made his life more comfortable. He'd had expectations of me, explicit or not, and I'd gone above and beyond in meeting them, which was why he'd been perfectly happy to coast along until I spoke up. The week after our breakup, I happened to be binge-watching Netflix's You, a thriller about an obsessive man who stalks and kills in the name of a twisted form of love. I joked to my brother, well, at least none of my exes have been serial killers. My 20-year-old brother looked at me with far too much pity and wisdom. Sis, if that's your bar, it's in the earth's mantle. Oof. I went back to writing my book with puffy eyes and a clearer head. Nothing had changed in my imaginary world, but everything had shifted in my real one. As I deleted words, I deleted the point system in the back of my mind. As I adjusted dialogue, I adjusted my personal bar. I had to. It was a trap, these men who feared being held to any expectations at all. They'd always made me feel like my expectations were unrealistic, because expecting anything would always be too much. That's no way to live. A relationship is nothing but a series of expectations, one plot point at a time. I wouldn't impose that kind of mind game on my characters, so how could I impose it on myself? A while after that relationship ended, I found myself with another man. He made me feel relaxed and happy. He was funny and considerate and nice, nicer than anyone I dated in a while. Perhaps I thought eyeing him next to me too nice. What was his game? Was he trying to lull me into a false sense of safety so he could do his worst? Was this a you situation? I don't understand how you're still single, he said, which is a cute thing to say to a date. I was just wondering if you're going to kill me, I squeaked back, which, judging by his face, is a weird thing to say on a date. Why would you think that? Because I'm still scrubbing the programming that told me being romantic is foolish and misery is more realistic than happiness. It was only like our fourth date, though, so instead of explaining all that, I settled for no reason. It may have taken me until my mid-30s, but now I finally believe what I've been telling other people for a decade. What romances have been telling me for most of my life. Love and kindness and respect, and yes, orgasms, are not asking for too much. Feeling secure and happy is the bare minimum of what any relationship should deliver. Returning texts and not ghosting and showing general interest are good things, but if they are the bar, then my baby brother is right. It is subterranean. When the world tells me I'm too picky or that my points are decreasing, I'll return to the utterly achievable, aspirational world found in between the covers of a romance novel. The ones I have on my keeper shelf affirm that I don't have to prove my value to a mate by being useful or successful, that I don't have to be perfect. And it's not unrealistic to expect my partner to be the best version of themselves, or for us to be happier together than we are alone. Somewhere out there, there's someone who badly wants to rise to the occasion and clear the reasonable high bar I've set with flying leaps. If he can do that, it's okay if he's not a billionaire Navy SEAL with six-pack abs who moonlights as a Viking cowboy. Though, hey, if he is, then that's okay too. We'll end this week with a message from Oprah. You know, graduation season is officially upon us. It is such a special time of year as students take that leap forward into the next chapter of their lives, bringing with them all that they've learned and their hopes of who they're going to become. And after last year, when so many people did not get to have a traditional ceremony, this year feels even more meaningful. While most of you Oprah insiders I know are likely past the graduation rite of passage, as we all leap forward and regain some normalcy in our lives, why not look ahead with the wide eyes and enthusiasm of a recent graduate? Because, you know, we are all in the midst of graduating from a worldwide pandemic. So let's just acknowledge that. High-five ourselves, we survived that. And then recharge our values, rediscover our optimism, and choose what matters most. Graduate to a reimagined version of who we want to be as the world opens back up. Right now, we're all getting a commencement with the opportunity for a new beginning. That's what's happening. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.